I've got to get some food into my dad to balance out what he's had to drink. There's some frozen pizza I can heat up. How about that and some orange juice?
Griffin was forced to shout over the music that thumped in the living room, some kind of heavy metal that made her head hurt. Cheyenne nodded. She pulled the quilt back over her and closed her eyes. She didn't need to do that for it to be dark, of course, but it was a way of signaling that she didn't want to talk anymore. She half-dozed until Griffin sat down on the edge of the bed and lifted the quilt away from her.
I thought I would eat in here with you.
As she pushed herself into a sitting position, Cheyenne could smell herself, the rank scents of fear and fever. It was strange how quickly things could become normal, she thought as she took the plate from Griffin's hand. She didn't like to be dirty or cold. She didn't like people telling her what to do, but here she was, feeling almost like it was an expected part of her routine. The same with the cord knotted around her ankle. She didn't even really notice it anymore. At least someone had turned down the music to a more tolerable level.
There's a glass about 6 inches to the left of your elbow, Griffin said, at 10 o'clock.
She picked up one of the two slices on her plate and took a bite. Pepperoni, tasting mostly of salt and fat, with a big, pillowy crust.
Danielle was really into healthy eating.
She would be horrified by this pizza. Cheyenne took another bite. Maybe she would be home by tomorrow. Maybe in 24 hours, she would be just getting out of the shower and sliding between fresh sheets.
Griffin spoke around a mouthful of food. What's it like being blind?
Do you think about what it's like to have hair every second? Cheyenne blew air out of her nose. It's just who I am now. I try not to think about it all the time. Which was true, but it didn't work. She never really forgot that she was blind, and even if she did for a minute, she could count on there being a reminder, usually painful. She sighed. At first, it feels like someone has thrown a blanket over your head. Some days you just want to scream, I'm inside here! Doesn't anybody out there see that? Doesn't anybody remember me? I'm still the same person. Cheyenne fell silent. She knew the last sentence wasn't true, even if she wanted it to be. She wasn't the same person. Being blind gave me a whole new life. I didn't ask for it. She licked the grease from her fingers. That's why I'd rather talk to someone on the phone or computer. Because then we're the same. We're equals.
What do you mean, equals?
Cheyenne tried to put into words what she had never before said out loud. Think about how much of talking has to do with what you see and not what you hear. When you meet new people, you can tell a lot about them even before they've opened their mouth, just by their clothes, how they stand, the expression on their face. But I don't see any of that stuff anymore. Plus, in real life, I'm always talking to people who have already walked away, or I answer people who aren't really talking to me. But when I talk to someone on the computer or the phone, we're at the same level. We know exactly the same amount of information. While she spoke, Cheyenne slipped her hand into her coat pocket and felt the piece of glass nestled in the kibble. It reassured her a bit. The glass was like a secret weapon. She ran her finger lightly along one edge, even as she spoke without a pause. She knew Griffin had no idea what she was doing. Sighted people always had to look, even at things their fingers were already telling them about. They couldn't find what was in their pockets without looking down, couldn't hunt through a purse without sticking their head inside. She knew because she had once been one of them. But blind people knew how to do things without giving themselves away. Their hands could work in the dark, like moles, blindly tunneling but always getting where they needed to go. Blind people could look like they were paying attention to you when they were really paying attention to something else.
What happened, anyway? Your dad said you were in an accident?
The silence stretched out before Cheyenne finally found herself answering him. It was the summer I was 13. My mom grew up in Medford, and we were down there visiting my grandmother. Just the two of us. My dad was on a business trip. Because of Nike, he travels a lot. She took a deep breath. We had gone for a long walk, and the sun had just set. It was me, my mom, and my dog, Spencer. We were facing traffic, walking down this long, straight road without any sidewalks, just gravel on the side of the road. Each car that came up behind us would throw our shadows way ahead of us, so they were as long as the block and really thin. As she spoke, she saw it with her mind's eye. Then, as each car got closer, our shadows got closer and closer and shorter and shorter. I told my mom it looked like our shadows were walking backward. That was the last thing I ever said to her. She remembered how her mom had smiled in the half-light, her curls wild as they often were by the end of the day. Her mom had been beautiful. At least that's how Cheyenne remembered it. Her mom didn't spend nearly as much time at the hairstylist or the gym as Danielle did. But she did have plenty of time for Cheyenne. They had laughed at the same jokes, jokes her dad never thought were all that funny. Every Saturday, her mom had taken her to the library, and they had each come home with a big stack of books. When anybody asked Cheyenne what had happened to her, she always just said, "car accident," in a tone that made it clear she didn't want to say one more word about it. She never talked about it. Never. Now she took a shuddery breath. One minute, we were walking, watching our shadows come back to us. The next minute, two cars were coming up behind us. It was two kids racing, so one was in the wrong lane, the lane closest to us. Then that guy saw the headlights of a car coming toward him and panicked. He swerved and hit us. She didn't say that her mom's body had ended up almost a block from where they were first hit. The car ran right over Spencer. That was my dog. It didn't hit me full on or I'd be dead too. Instead, it threw me into a speed limit sign. The top of my head smacked into the pole. Cheyenne realized she was unconsciously pushing her fingers through her bangs, which she always carefully fluffed so that the scar wouldn't show. Her index finger traced the twists of its raised edges. And my brain got bounced off the back of my skull. And when that happened, it killed the part that tells me what I'm seeing. So my eyes still work. My brain just can't understand the message. There was a long silence. Then Griffin asked softly, "Were you knocked unconscious?" "Only for a few seconds. When I woke up, I couldn't see anything. I could feel the blood running down my face, and I told myself that was why I couldn't see. I knew my arm was broken, but everything else seemed to be okay. I was screaming for my mom, feeling around with my good arm. All I could find was one of her shoes. I guess she was literally knocked out of them." Cheyenne fell silent, her head crowded with memories. 18. Big words scare me. Griffin couldn't sleep. The floor was hard, and the cold seeped up through the old sleeping bag. Exhausted, Cheyenne had dozed off after dinner. Griffin had pulled the quilt over her and then hadn't known what to do with himself. By that time, his dad had been singing along with the stereo, but Griffin knew that when Roy drank, his mood could turn on a dime. Griffin stayed in his bedroom, sitting on the far edge of the bed, alternately looking at comic books and watching Cheyenne, until finally his dad had turned off the music and staggered to bed. Griffin hadn't known where to sleep. He had thought about sleeping on the couch, but he didn't want to leave Cheyenne alone. Partly he wanted to watch her. Partly he wanted to watch over her. He had finally settled for the floor. Now he regretted his decision. Cheyenne's sleep had turned restless, making it even harder for him to doze off. She kept moaning and kicking her feet. Finally, he sat up and looked at her. He could make out the dark tangle of her hair, but that was about it. She sounded like she had gotten sicker, but in the dark, it was hard to judge just how sick she really was. Then Griffin realized that the normal rules didn't apply. Moving quietly, he got up and flicked on the light, wincing at the sudden brightness. Cheyenne didn't stir. She lay curled on her side. He knelt down next to the bed so he could look at her more closely. Her mouth was full and soft, the lips slightly parted. When she exhaled, her breath rattled in her chest. Black strands of damp hair clung to her flushed face. It looked like she had a fever. Griffin's hand hovered over her forehead, then gently pressed down. Her expression didn't change. She seemed hot. But how hot, exactly? If your fever got too high, couldn't it damage your brain? Griffin put his free hand on his own forehead. That felt hot, too. He tried moving his right hand from Cheyenne's forehead to his own, but he couldn't really feel any difference, except that hers was clammy and his wasn't. Obviously, his palm was useless as a thermometer. Then he had an idea. If he touched his forehead to hers, he would be able to tell for sure how much warmer she was. Griffin leaned forward and tentatively pressed his forehead against Cheyenne's. Definitely warmer. Was her brain cooking inside her skull? While he was still wondering if he should just try to sneak her out of the house and dump her outside a hospital, Cheyenne sat up with a jerk. Their heads cracked together. She yelped and pushed him away.
Shh!
He didn't want her to wake Roy.
It's just me, Griffin.
Cheyenne dropped her own voice to a whisper.
What are you doing?
She sounded clearer than he thought he would in similar circumstances.
Are you trying to kiss me or something?
No.
To his embarrassment, his voice broke.
I was just trying to figure out if you had a fever.
And?
And I think you do.
I know that.
She sat up, scooted back until her shoulders were against the wall, folded her arms, and rested them on top of her knees. She still wore her striped scarf and the puffy silver coat. Griffin persisted.
But I think you're sicker than you were.
He thought of what her father had said on the radio. Cheyenne couldn't really die from pneumonia, could she? Although didn't people used to die from pneumonia back in the old days before there were antibiotics? They must have been thinking along the same lines, because Cheyenne said,
The doctor said that pneumonia used to be called the old man's friend, because that's what a lot of people died from when they were old and frail.
Some friend,
Griffin said, then added,
Wait a second, I have an idea.
He tiptoed down the hall and into the bathroom. The shower curtain still lay in the bottom of the tub.
Crap.
He had forgotten about that. Cheyenne's escape attempt seemed like it had happened in another lifetime. He tried to hang the curtain back up, wincing as it rattled, but it had ripped away from the rings. When Roy asked, Griffin was going to have to say that he had tripped and fallen. Or maybe, Griffin realized, that Cheyenne had. That was more believable. He let the curtain fall back into the tub, then knelt and opened up the cupboard beneath the sink. Under the silver curve of pipe, a blue plastic basket held rubbing alcohol, Advil, a broken comb, and stray band-aids. No thermometer. But mixed in were all kinds of medicines that, for one reason or another, had never been used or used up. Griffin pawed through muscle relaxants, rash creams, and cough suppressants. He scooped up the Advil and cough medicine. Then, after holding up amber bottle after amber bottle to the light, he finally saw, with a surge of triumph, the word Cipro. He knew that Cipro was an antibiotic. The printed label read, Janie Sawyer. It was kind of a surprise to see his mom's name. He had a sudden flash of memory. Her dark eyes, her high cheekbones, the long reddish-brown hair that fell to her waist. She had hidden behind that hair when she was angry or sad or any of a dozen emotions that Roy didn't want to hear about. Sometimes she had stood up to Roy, but not very often. And Roy had only gotten worse after she left. According to the label on the bottle, the prescription had expired 6.5 years ago, 1 year to the day after his mom had filled it. But what were the chances that a medicine suddenly gave up the ghost exactly 365 days later? They probably had to put that date on for legal reasons, or to give them an excuse to sell you some more. Griffin opened the bottle. The white capsules looked okay. He sniffed. They didn't smell like anything in particular. The directions said you were supposed to take one pill 3 times a day for 7 days. There weren't that many pills left. Maybe 8 or 9. But it would be enough to give Cheyenne a start. In the kitchen, he filled one of the glasses he had washed earlier. Back in his bedroom, he softly closed the door behind him and then said in a half whisper, "Since you can't go pick up your prescription, I thought the prescription should come to you." Cheyenne looked confused. "What?"
"Cipro."
Griffin rattled the bottle. When she still looked blank, he added, "It's an antibiotic."
"But don't they use different kinds of antibiotics depending on what you're sick with? What if this one doesn't work for pneumonia?"
"I don't see how you would be any worse off."
Why didn't she appreciate the effort he was making?
"Look, it probably can't hurt, and it might help."
"But what if it only half kills the pneumonia bacteria and the rest of them come back stronger? We've been learning about antibiotic resistance in biology."
Griffin sighed and sat down on the bed.
"What is it with you? Does everything have to be an argument or a discussion?"
She answered him seriously.
"Yes.
Yes, it does."
Her roughened voice made her sound older.
"Well, take one anyway.
Plus, I've got Advil for your fever and medicine for your cough." He pressed the pills into one hand and the glass into the other. Would it help if she doubled up the number of antibiotics? He realized he could tell her the package said whatever he wanted. That she was to take them 10 times a day with wine, or once every 2 weeks, even that they were some different drug entirely. Instead, he said,
"Where are you taking biology? Are you going to a special school for blind people?"
Cheyenne shook her head.
"I'm mainstreamed. I go to Catlin Gable."
Griffin snorted.
"Mainstreamed? Even I know that's a fancy pants private school."
Cheyenne flushed.
"Well, it's not some special school for the handicapped, anyway. I'm the only blind person there, which can be kind of hard. Sometimes teachers forget and point at things or write stuff on the board and don't say what they've written. It doesn't happen so much now that I've got Phantom. It's like he's a visual cue.
Oh, right, Cheyenne's blind." She put the pills in her mouth, took a sip of water, and tipped her head back. He watched her throat move up and down.
"What other classes are you taking besides biology?"
She set the glass on the dresser and rubbed her face.
"Advanced placement history, German, junior level English, and trig."
"Oh,"
Griffin said. He felt stupid, the way he used to feel when he still went to school. She didn't seem to notice.
"Since I'm blind, I have to take extra classes. I have a computer class in a special room they set up for me. The computers at school and at home have a program that can read to me, although sometimes it pronounces things wrong, and the voice is really flat."
Cheyenne said the next few words like a robot.
"And it reads every word I type, so I know right away if I make a mistake."
"What about the reading assignments? Do you have a machine that reads books to you?"
"Reading." Cheyenne let out a long sigh. "I miss reading, you know? Just picking up a book. There's a million ways to read if you're blind, but none of them are as good. Sometimes Danielle pays someone to read to me, and volunteers read my textbooks. With one of them, it's some guy who always sounds like he has a cold.
With a code.
It's nearly impossible to make out what he's saying. That's why I like CDs and downloads so much better, you know? Like books on tape, the same as sighted people buy. Have you ever heard the guy who reads Harry Potter?" Her face lit up. "He's wonderful. He has a different voice for every character."
Griffin smiled back at her. Cheyenne was smiling too, but of course it wasn't a shared smile. It must be weird not to be able to have a nonverbal conversation just by rolling your eyes at someone, or grinning, or stifling a yawn.
"But when I read on my own," Cheyenne continued, "I'm not a very good reader."
Griffin was surprised.
"Really? But you're smart."
"I mean, I'm not that good at Braille.
Braille's like those little dots on the elevator buttons, right?
She nodded. Yeah. You feel the different dots in each Braille cell. You have to memorize what each of them means. I have friends who were born blind, and they're a lot faster than me. They can even use both hands to read. I can't do that. I have to go really slow. And even then I get confused. If I get one dot wrong, then it could mean an entirely different word.
Big words scare me.
Cheyenne had no idea how well Griffin understood her.
But you would know big words if someone said them to you, right?
Of course. I just can't read them.
I have a hard time reading, too, he admitted. Last year, I had to read aloud in class, and there was this word, and I kept saying it, Bree, fly. Bree fly. It was supposed to be an article about flowers, but all I could think about was a piece of cheese with a fly on it.
Bree fly, Cheyenne said, echoing the way he had said it before she got it right. Oh, briefly. It makes sense. Have you ever been tested for dyslexia?
I'm not retarded,
Griffin said quickly, wishing that he hadn't opened up to her. No, that's not what being dyslexic means. Dyslexia is having trouble with the physical part of reading, not the comprehension part. Like me having trouble with Braille. She straightened up. You could get tapes from the same place I do. They're not only for blind people. You just order them through the school district.
What makes you think I'm still going to school?
Griffin said, feeling deflated. He had been hoping she thought he was about 30.
30 seemed like a good age.
You live with your dad, for one thing. Cheyenne shrugged. I don't know. The more I listened to you, the more I figured you were about my age. Blind people are good at sizing other people up. She leaned forward. That's why I know you're not like the other guys here. 19. Nothing but ifs. Cheyenne could do the math. These men thought they could get $5 million from her dad. And they probably could, if he had enough time. And after that, they would have two choices. Choice one, free the girl who could help the police find them. Choice two, kill the girl and find a good place to hide her body. And the longer she was here, the more they might start thinking that it wasn't in their best interests to pick the first choice, because, blind or not, she would know too much. Forcing herself to take a deep breath, Cheyenne tried to calm down. These guys were criminals, yes, but they were car thieves, not killers, and that was a pretty big difference. Griffin had kidnapped her only by accident. And while it was true that he could go to jail for that, maybe his sentence wouldn't be too bad because he hadn't meant to do it. But murder. She forced herself to think of what she really meant. Actually killing her. For that, they could be put to death themselves. That had to serve as a deterrent, didn't it? But then Cheyenne thought of how empty the roads had been on the way here, and the impression of stillness and space that had surrounded them as they walked to the house. Even though the punishment for murder was much worse than it was for kidnapping, that still assumed someone would find her body. Her head felt muddled and thick, but she forced herself to think straight. Just by the way the three older men treated her, she could tell that they saw her as a thing, not a person. They probably saw everyone as things, but her blindness just made it easier for them to write her off. Griffin was the only one who might want to save her. Cheyenne had to make sure he continued to see her as a person. She had to make him care about protecting her. She had to give him a reason to hesitate. No more arguing with him, she vowed. No more fighting. Because her life depended on it. But Cheyenne knew it was a one-way street. If she had a moment when she might turn the tables, she had to be willing to do whatever it took, even if it meant hurting Griffin, even if it meant worse than that. Because she was pretty sure this situation was going to end with somebody dead. After a long pause, Griffin said,
"How come you think I'm not like them?"
She couldn't read the emotions that colored his voice. "You're kind, for one thing. And for another, I think you're smarter than they are."
Cheyenne was telling the truth.
If she had to lie, she hoped she could make that sound like the truth, too. He shook his head hard enough that she could feel it because the bed wiggled.
I'm not smart. I dropped out of school before they could kick me out.
I don't believe it. Maybe you have troubles reading, but I do too, and I'm still smart. And so are you. If you start believing what other people think, you'll never get anywhere.
Cheyenne thought of her biology teacher, Mr. Waddell. Even though he insisted his name was Waddell, the kids all called him Mr. Waddle.
Just because you have a handicap, I'm not going to be lenient with you, he had informed Cheyenne, asking her to stay behind after her first class with him. Don't expect any special considerations from me. You will be treated like any other student.
Of course. Was he really any worse than Ms. Crispin, who taught English? For their project, everyone in the group had gotten a failing grade. Cheyenne got a B for the exact same project. 2 weeks ago, Ms. Crispin had said to Cheyenne,
I wanted to tell you how impressed I am. You can hardly tell you have a handicap.
Griffin's bitter voice snapped Cheyenne back into the here and now.
You really think it makes any difference what I think of myself? You really think I could be anybody I wanted to, even President of the United States? You've got to face facts, Cheyenne. You're blind, which means you're never going to be able to do a million things. And the facts of my life mean I don't have many choices either. I don't have many choices at all.
So does that mean you just have to go along with what's happening here? Just because you took my stepmom's car doesn't mean you have to keep going down this road with them.
What are you thinking? Are you thinking I'm going to drive you to the police station and turn myself in?
Put like that, Cheyenne could hear how ridiculous the idea was. But what would happen to her? She blurted out her fear.
I don't think they're ever going to let me go.
Of course they will.
Griffin sounded like he was trying to convince himself.
You know as well as I do what the easiest solution would be, Cheyenne countered. For them to keep the money and get rid of me. I'm the only witness. Probably nobody saw you at the shopping mall, certainly not well enough to recognize you. And it was a fluke thing. You have no connection to my family or to me, none. Meanwhile, the police will be looking at people connected to Catelyn Gable, and every housekeeper and groundskeeper we've ever had, and people Dad knows through Nike. They'll look at everyone who works at Nike now or who has ever worked there, including all the people who have been fired from Nike and all the people who hate Nike because they think it has overseas sweatshops.
That's a pretty big list. That's practically the United States of America.
Right, Cheyenne said. So what are the chances that they'll find you guys? Probably pretty slim. Unless you give me back. And those other guys won't believe me if I say I won't tell. That if you let me go, I won't say anything. But I promise I won't.
We're gonna give you back, okay? We'll take you someplace safe and turn you loose.
Griffin sounded as if he wished he believed what he was saying. There had to be a way for her to get out of this alive, Cheyenne thought. There had to.
What would have happened if I had gone through the bathroom window? What's back there anyway?
Nothing. No people anyway, at least not for most of it. It's just woods. It stretches on for miles. To the east there's a river, to the west there's our road, and after about 4 miles that meets up with the bigger road. But it's still pretty quiet. You probably would have just wandered around and got lost and died. It gets down pretty far below freezing at night.
Cheyenne opened her mouth to say something, but found herself yawning, so she made a creaking noise. She felt his cool hand on her forehead.
I think the Advil brought your fever down. You need to get to sleep. We both do.
He pulled the blanket up to her chin.
The floor's too hard. I'm going to sleep on the other side of the bed in a sleeping bag. Don't worry. I won't bother you or anything.
Cheyenne knew that if she could see, Griffin's face would be bright red. She heard him stand up, turn off the light, then felt him sit on the other side of the bed, rustling as he got into his sleeping bag. No part of him touched her, so she knew he must be lying just on the edge of the bed. She was exhausted. But she was also wide awake. She couldn't pin her hopes on Griffin. He might stop things from happening, but he probably wouldn't. After all, he was just a kid, like her. Long after Griffin's breathing had reached an even rhythm, Cheyenne lay awake, trying to think of a way out. If she could get to a phone. If she could find another way to alert the authorities. If she could persuade Griffin to save her. If she could escape. Nothing but ifs. 20. Let's send him a finger. When Griffin woke up, he didn't know where he was. He was on the wrong side of the bed, in a sleeping bag, with someone breathing right next to him. And then it all came back to him in a rush. He levered himself on one elbow. Cheyenne's breathing hitched, but then straightened out again. Her face was still pale, except for the flush across her cheeks, but she didn't look as bad as she had the night before. He wondered if this was how married people felt when one of them woke up and the other one was still asleep. Her mouth was soft and vulnerable. Underneath her pale lids, her eyes moved back and forth. What was she seeing in her dreams? Even though he had gotten just a few hours of sleep, Griffin was now wide awake. He managed to get off the bed with a minimum of rustling. He padded out into the kitchen, the floor icy under his bare feet. The wood stove was going in the living room, but the heat only went so far. Griffin was surprised to find Roy awake, leaning against the counter, drinking coffee. Next to him, the phone lay on the counter, or what was left of the phone. Someone had taken a hammer to it. Now it was shards of plastic and colorful wires. Griffin was surprised he hadn't heard his dad wailing on it the night before. He poked at it.
What happened to the phone?
Roy shrugged.
Insurance. I don't want her getting loose and calling anyone. Now she can't.
His eyes were bloodshot and his hands shaky. Griffin wondered why his dad hadn't just unplugged it and stuck it on a high shelf, but there was no use asking.
What if I need to call someone? You can use that cell I got.
He looked over Griffin's shoulder.
Is she sleeping?
Yeah. In the middle of the night, she seemed like she was running a fever. I went through the stuff in the bathroom and found an old prescription of Mom's to give her. At the mention of the bathroom, Griffin had been sure his dad would remember to ask what had happened to the shower curtain. Instead, he just looked startled.
Your mom's? Really?
His dad never talked about his mom anymore. But after Griffin came home from the hospital, he would sometimes find his dad crying and holding something that used to belong to his mom. A bracelet or a sweater. She had left a lot of stuff behind. They had had a big fight about what had happened to Griffin. It must have been the last straw, because she had taken off with her purse and her car and some pictures of Griffin, and that was it. Gone so good that she never looked back. Mom had the prescription filled a few months before she left, but she only took about half the pills. Roy nodded and lifted the cup of coffee to his lips. Griffin couldn't read the expression on his face. They heard the front door open and then the sounds of TJ and Jimbo coming in.
What's the word?
Jimbo asked when he walked into the kitchen. Today he was wearing an extra-long stocking cap and padded ski pants.
Have you talked to them? I got off the phone with the dad about 20 minutes ago. He says they can't raise that kind of money. Not in cash. Not that fast. I'll bet we can speed things up, Jimbo said. Let's send him a finger.
Griffin couldn't tell if he was joking.
Or an ear,
TJ added. He definitely wasn't joking. To Griffin's intense relief, Roy shook his head.
We do that, and they'll decide she might be dead already, and hunt us down with guns blazing. We start chopping off body parts, and they'll figure they've got nothing left to lose.
Did they say how much they could give us? Griffin asked. He kept his voice soft, hoping to influence the others to talk more quietly. He couldn't imagine what it would be like for Cheyenne if she woke up and heard them talking about lopping off her fingers or ears.
A million.
Setting down his coffee cup, Roy scrubbed his face with open palms.
I told him I would call him back.
His voice was glum, even though a few days ago he would have been over the moon about the prospect of getting $1 million.
That's still a lot, Griffin said. That's like $250,000 apiece.
Roy shook his head.
You're still a minor, and you still live under my roof. I'm going to watch after your share.
TJ and Jimbo exchanged a look.
Do you really think that's fair? Jimbo asked. You get a cool $500,000 and we only get half of that?
Roy straightened up, and Jimbo and TJ automatically took a step back.
Hey, I'm the one who is taking all the risks here. She's on my property, and it's my voice that's getting tape recorded every time I call. And I'm the one figuring out the logistics.
Logistics? TJ echoed. It was clear the word wasn't quite familiar.
The plans. When I call back, I'll tell the dad to be ready to make the drop at 3 this morning. Then, at 3, I'll tell him to drive someplace. But when he gets there, we'll tell him to take another phone we'll have waiting and ditch his first one. I'll have one of you there watching to make sure he does leave his phone. The new phone will have outgoing calls disabled, so he won't be able to tip anyone off. And then I'll call him on the new phone and tell him to make the drop at Ironwood Road.
Ironwood Road was a long stretch that linked together two other equally desolate roads. It was quiet no matter what time of the day or night it was. At 3 in the morning in the middle of winter, it would be dead.
And I'll have one of you watching Ironwood Road before he even knows that's the drop site. Then we'll grab the money and leave the bag in case they put something in it, like a tracer or those exploding dye packs they use on bank robbers. Then we'll come back here and split up the money and go our separate ways.
Jimbo let out a whistle.
Sounds slick.
Griffin didn't care about the money. The idea of it didn't even seem real.
After we get the money, then what? I think we should all get out of town, Roy said. I know I am. I'm headed down to the airport to get on the first flight I can find to someplace warm where they put an umbrella in your drink.
Wait, we won't be working here no more?
TJ looked confused.
You won't need to work, dummy.
Jimbo shook his head.
That's the whole point. You won't need to work for years and years. If we go down to some place where they don't ever see tourists and haven't jacked up their prices, we'll never run out of money.
Griffin couldn't believe they seemed to have forgotten the girl who was in the middle of all this.
But what about Cheyenne?
Roy's face twisted.
What about her? We'll let her go, right? We've never used our names, and of course she has no idea what we look like.
Griffin made his voice as certain as he could. Hearing Cheyenne say, I know your name, it's Griffin. And now I know for sure your dad's name is Roy. When I tell the police that, they'll find you in a minute. Griffin didn't know how to make things right. He just knew that he couldn't stand by and let something bad happen to Cheyenne.
Roy looked skeptical. Sooner or later, she'll tell them something that will let them know exactly where we are.
Griffin remembered his earlier conversation with Cheyenne.
Not if we're careful, she won't. For one thing, she's the daughter of Nike's president. Do you know how many people would want a piece of that pie? When you call back, you can say something to make them think it's all about Nike. They'll spend years tracking down every person who's protested against them or worked there, and they'll never find us, because they won't realize it was random, that it didn't have anything to do with Nike at all.
Roy thought about this for a while. The other three were silent, watching him.
On the way to the airport, we can slip up into Washington and drop her off along a logging road or something. Griffin said, point her in the right direction and tell her to start walking. And by the time somebody finds her, we'll be on the beach with our Mai Tais. Of course, Roy said.
Griffin was pretty sure Roy had never said, of course, before in his life. At least not when he meant it. 21. Intelligent disobedience. For a few minutes after she woke up, Cheyenne didn't know where she was. And then she remembered, and wished she hadn't. By the sliver of light she could see with her left eye, Cheyenne decided that it was morning. Real light was warmer, somehow, than light that came from a bulb. But when she felt her watch, she was surprised to find it was 1:20. So afternoon, not morning. Then someone opened the bedroom door. Cheyenne braced herself.
"Are you awake?"
When she heard Griffin's voice, relief flooded through her. "Yeah." She pushed herself up until her back was against the wall.
"I brought you some Advil to keep your fever down and another one of those antibiotics. Plus OJ to wash it down with and some crackers. I'll put the crackers at 9 o'clock.
She felt him settle on the bed by her feet, and then he put the glass in one hand and the pills in the other.
"Thanks," she said, trying to sound like she meant it.
"When am I going home?"
"Soon. My dad's just making the final arrangements. There's going to be a drop tonight at 3, and then we'll drive you someplace and let you go."
His voice changed to a whisper, and he leaned close enough that she could feel his breath stir her hair.
"The thing is, you can't let on that you know my name or my dad's name. You have to act like you don't know anything."
Cheyenne nodded, biting her lip. Griffin's soft whisper continued.
"You know how you told me about how many enemies your dad must have? They'll probably say some stuff to try to make you think that you being kidnapped is connected to Nike. Pretend like you believe them."
Cheyenne didn't know who to believe.
"Griffin, you've got to promise that they will let me go. Promise me."
He was quiet for a long time. Finally, he whispered,
"I promise."
Cheyenne started shivering, and it wasn't just from being sick. She was afraid that Griffin's hesitation had said more than his words. In a more normal voice, he asked,
"So how do you get to school? In a limo?"
"Are you kidding? Danielle usually takes me. My dad might make a lot of money, but he doesn't flaunt it. He's not one of those gross, balding guys who drives a Hummer so he can feel more like a real man." She decided not to mention the housekeeper and the cook. She wanted Griffin to continue to think they had things in common.
"On TV, your dad said you have a guide dog. Do you use your dog or a cane to get places?"
The thought of Phantom and her ruined cane made Cheyenne's head feel liquid again. She wouldn't cry. "Mostly I take Phantom, but I took my cane yesterday because my stepmom thought it would be easier."
"Is it weird being towed around by a dog? Can you really trust it?"
From the way he said it, Cheyenne wondered how many things Griffin trusted. "I've only had Phantom 3 months, but it feels like forever. I wish it had been forever. But you can't get a guide dog until you're 16. She thought of how she had woken the first morning after she got Phantom to find his head draped across her neck. At that moment, Cheyenne had known they belonged together. "And I totally trust him. He watches out for anything that might hurt me. Curbs, low-hanging branches, skateboarders, telephone poles, holes in the sidewalk. Once he even saved my life." Griffin touched her knee.
"What happened?"
"I was crossing at an intersection when this car turned right without even stopping. Phantom threw himself against my legs and pushed me until I stepped back." Cheyenne remembered the screech of skidding tires, the rush of air as a car whizzed by so close that the fender must have ruffled Phantom's fur. Other drivers had honked and yelled, but the car never stopped. "If Phantom hadn't pushed me out of the way, we would both probably have been killed. And if I had just had my cane, I definitely would have been killed."
"So using a dog is better than using a cane?"
"Everything is better with a guide dog. The difference between having a dog and a cane is astronomical. Before, it was like I was invisible. Now people talk to me. They tell me how smart Phantom is, even if he's just lying down. They tell me stories about their dogs. They want to pet him. Sometimes I have to be kind of snippy, you know, my dog is working. But the biggest difference is just in getting around. Now I zip through people and it's smooth. Phantom is so good that I can walk down the hall at school and never even rub shoulders with anyone else. When Cheyenne had first gone back to school, with only her cane to guide her, it had been so hard. Except for Kenzie and Sadie, most of her friends had hung back as if Cheyenne was a different person, someone they didn't even know. The thing was, they were right. Before the accident, Cheyenne had been outgoing. She sang to herself, chattered, laughed, called out to everyone she saw in the halls. After the accident, she quieted down. It was more than just sadness. Without her sight, her ears were her connection to other human beings. Blindness took away the nonverbal cues that let her know whether someone else was tired, sad, happy, or worried. If she listened closely, she could still pick these emotions up in voices. But as a result, her own voice was muted. The rehab center had corridors just wide enough for two people to pass each other. At Catlin Gable, the walls seemed like they were miles apart. If it was crowded, she was forced to walk in the middle of the hall, without the security of a wall. The worst part were the breaks between classes, when she had only a few minutes to get to the next room. If she was hurrying and ran into someone, it embarrassed them, which meant it totally embarrassed Cheyenne. Then once she was in the right classroom, and before she got Phantom, she could never be completely sure that she was. She had to find her chair with a minimum of bumping, wondering who the boys were on either side, who was watching her, if they were laughing. She wanted to be cool and graceful, but instead she felt clumsy and sweaty. Now, with Phantom, Cheyenne walked with poise and speed. He had returned her body to her. Just thinking about Phantom made Cheyenne's eyes sting with tears. She loved the soft fur of his ears, his long, slender muzzle, even the sound of his toenails on the floor. Phantom tried to keep quiet when he was getting into mischief because he had figured out that Cheyenne couldn't see him. When he was thirsty, he scraped his bowl along the floor to let her know. When he wanted a treat, he barked and put his paws on the counter. And when he was tired, he curled up under Cheyenne's desk or inside the empty fireplace, even in the shower stall. Cheyenne hoped it wasn't really obvious that she was crying again. At the same time, she didn't want to stop talking. Not when Griffin seemed interested. She wanted to bind him to her with gauzy ropes of words. She took a deep breath and said, "But a dog's not just a machine. You don't work your dog when you're at home. A dog needs time to just be a dog. How about that dog you've got outside? When is it ever just a dog?" "Duke?" Griffin let out a surprised laugh. "Duke's not a dog. Not really." He snorted again, as if the idea was ridiculous. Then he asked, "So how does your dog know where to take you?" Cheyenne shook her head. "He doesn't. It's not like Phantom's a cab driver. I can't say, 'McDonald's, please,' and have him take me there. I do half the work. I need to have a map inside my head of all the streets we'll cross and tell him when to make all the turns. When I get to an intersection, I'm the one who has to decide whether the light is red or green just by listening. To a dog, red, green, and yellow look the same. Then when I reach the right block, I have to listen or feel for clues to help me find the building I want. I'm the navigator. Phantom is the one who makes sure I can walk there without running into anything or being run over."
"Wait. You just get to a street and then listen to see if the cars are stopped? That sounds kind of dangerous. What happens if you tell Phantom to go but a car's coming?"
"Your dog is trained to judge whether your command is safe," Cheyenne said. "It's called intelligent disobedience." 22. A big mistake.
"Intelligent disobedience, huh?"
Griffin echoed. He liked the way it sounded. Whenever he didn't do what somebody wanted, they always assumed he was making a big mistake. "What's funny is that when Phantom doesn't do something I tell him to, I still get annoyed," Cheyenne said. "Like he's being stupid. And then I figure out that he's right." She drank her orange juice in one long gulp and then wiped the back of her mouth with her hand. She had already gobbled the crackers. Belatedly, Griffin realized she must be hungry.
Would you like some lunch?
She nodded.
Sure, that would be great.
I'll go see what I can find.
He got up, already mentally rummaging through the kitchen. There was some ramen in the cupboard and maybe some peas in the freezer. And he could cut up some hot dogs and put them in, too. He would break up the noodles so they wouldn't be too messy when Cheyenne ate them. He thought he would tell her how ramen was kind of like stone soup, because it was only good when you added a bunch of stuff to it. And maybe she would laugh, or at least smile. While Griffin was digging through the fridge, looking for eggs, TJ came in.
You making something to eat?
For our guest.
Got enough for TJ?
Griffin didn't like to say yes about anything to TJ, but he couldn't think of a good reason to say no. He nodded. As TJ went down the hall to the bathroom, Griffin took the pan off the heat and added more water so that the food would stretch further. It was only as he was slicing the hot dogs over the pan that his brain translated the sounds he had heard.